Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. A few months ago, Iranians elected a new president, Masoud Pezeshkian. A cardiac surgeon described as a reform politician, his victory surprised at least many foreign observers who are skeptical about all things Iranian, not the least that anyone could challenge what they think is the status quo and win an election against so-called hardliners. But what do those terms even mean in Iran, reformer and hardliner? Why are Westerners so skeptical about the concept of an Iranian election? More importantly, as one of the most significant countries in an increasingly volatile Middle East, what does Pezeshkian's victory mean for his country and for the region? The best answers to those questions should probably come from an Iranian. So my guest today is Hossein Mousavian, who is a scholar and author at Princeton University, and who was an Iranian diplomat working, among other things, on his country's nuclear file with the West. Welcome, Dr. Mousavian, to New Thinking for a New World.
Thank you very much, Alan. It's a pleasure for me to be with you.
Hossein, we'll get to the nuclear question in a few minutes, but I'd like to start with the election. The president won with a decisive victory over Saeed Jalili in the second round of an election in which something like half of the registered voters in Iranian actually voted, despite calls for boycott. How did Pezeshkian win? How did voters make that choice between him and, again, air quotes, hardliner Jalili, whom you know well from your negotiations past?
In Iran, there are two main political factions, neither of which can be eliminated, Alan. One faction is the conservative, known as principalists in Iran, and the other one is reformist moderate faction. This is similar to what we have in the US with Democratic and Republican parties, neither of which can be removed. The problem with the Iranian previous administration, whether conservative or reformist, was that whenever they won the presidential election, they would form an administration entirely from their own faction. As a result, they were not successful. They were unable to succeed because they faced severe opposition from the other faction. However, in the era of Pezeshkian, we are seeing some new developments, which it's really new during past 30 years. One is that the conservative faction has split into two groups, hardliners and the moderates. The hardliners, known as Resistant Front, or in Persian, Jebhe Paydari, who led by Jalili, which you mentioned, you named, oppose Pezeshkian. While the moderate faction of the conservatives, led by Qalibaf, the Speaker of Parliament, the current Speaker of the Parliament, are supporting and cooperating with him. The second important issue is that President Pezeshkian presented a cabinet to the parliament that included key figures from both big political factions. I mean, reformist moderates and moderate conservatives, not radical conservatives. That's why the parliament voted for approved all the ministers of Pezeshkian with no exception. It was really something new. The third significant fact, Alan, is that Pezeshkian had been disqualified by the Guardian Council, but with the support of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, he was able to enter the election and win. Therefore, I can say, as of now, he has the support of the Supreme Leader, even the Revolutionary Guard, the reformist moderate faction, and the moderate conservatives. That's why he practically, as of now, he has isolated the radical conservatives called Resistance Front, led by Jalili. And there is a good possibility that some positive developments may occur in Iran's domestic and foreign policy scene.
We'll go there in a second, but let's go back for one more moment to the election itself. Voters, pretty substantial majority in the second round, voted for the president, voted for Pezeshkian. What's the dynamic of that election?
See, the reality was that during the previous presidential election, for the first time, the rate of participants went a little bit below 50%. Every election after Iranian Revolution 1979 was above, the participation was above 50%, even up to 80%. And the beginning of revolution, it was more than 90%. When they, the conservatives, they joined together, I mean, the moderate and the radical faction of conservatives, they joined together and they established a new administration. After 3 years, then we had, after 2 years, then we had parliamentary election. And the rate of participant even decreased to something like 40%, 43, 44%. Then we had another election, the municipality election, or the second round of the parliament. It went even down to 40%. When we had the first round of presidential election, I mean, between mainly between Pezeshkian and Jalili, it was, it came up a little bit to 45%, but still it was below 50%. I believe this was a big warning to the whole system, to the establishment, that the reason people are not participating or we have low participation is because they are not satisfied with the efficiency of the system led by the conservatives. I think, to my personal understanding, is that the reason Supreme Leader intervened to support Pezeshkian, despite the disqualification of the Guardian Council to attend the presidential election, was that the leader wanted this time to have a higher rate of participation, and this could not happen without the participation of the reformists and the moderates, reformists led by President Khatami and moderates led by President Rouhani. When Pezeshkian was approved, qualified, then Khatami and all reformists, they announced they will vote and they will participate. Rouhani announced. Then we had 50%, almost 50% participation. And the history of election of Iran shows, Alan, whenever we have had participation above 60%, the reformists, they won. Whenever we had participation below 55% or close to 50%, principalists, they won. It means the majority of Iranian nation, they are more pro-reformist and they are looking for changes in domestic and foreign policy.
And presumably, although this is an amateur asking the question, the fact that the Supreme Leader in effect supported him produced some of that votes.
Yes, we can be sure. Definitely this was the case.
So let's talk about the challenges facing the administration, first domestic and then foreign. I have seen reports of widespread unrest. I read about a Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance survey that said a lot of people are very, very unhappy with inflation, with unemployment, with social and political conditions. Is that a fair description, do you think, of conditions in your country?
I would say, Alan, yes. Majority of the people, they are not satisfied. This is reality. Pezeshkian is facing with significant challenges. The first important challenge is the economic situation, the economic problems, such as inflation, high prices, the dramatic collapse of the national currency value of Iran. These economic problems, Alan, have accumulated over the 44 years since the Iranian Revolution. And solving them requires time and major decision by the establishment. And that's why no administration can manage it alone. The second challenge is sanctions. With the U.S. sanctions being the central issue. These sanctions cannot be resolved unless there is a major shift in the U.S.-Iran hostile relations that has persisted for the past four decades, unfortunately. The third major challenge for Pezeshkian is the reality of corruption within the governmental system, which has continuously grown since the revolution, and no administration has been able to address this problem. And I would say, last but not least, the fourth challenge is the state-controlled economy, which is the primary factor behind Iran's economy problem and complication and failures. According to Iranian law and regulations, even constitution, 80% of the state-owned enterprises were supposed to be transferred to the private or public sectors. However, no government after revolution has succeeded in privatization, and the state-controlled economy in Iran has continued to expand, leading to an increase in corruption as well. These are major domestic and perhaps foreign challenges Pezeshkian is faced with. And I believe he would never be able to address and to resolve alone, except if the whole establishment, like parliament, supreme leader, the Revolutionary Guard, they would support him to bring changes.
And what is your assessment? Clearly, the supreme leader supports him. What about the rest of the establishment?
You know, There are some very, very important issues about the personality of Pezeshkian, Alan. First of all, he is not really factional. He is reformist. But practically, history shows that he is really beyond political factions. The second fact is that he has lived for 40 years clean. Very, very clean. No one could bring any issue about financial or corruption issues in his life. The third is important issue is that he was at the war front as a physician for many years, and he really put his life at danger at the forefront of the war during Saddam's invasion of Iran. Therefore, no one can tell him you are not revolutionary. And the fourth important issue, he is very, very high-level educated. He was educated at Harvard, in European universities, UK, Geneva, in Tehran University. He is a heart surgeon. No one can question the level of his academics. And the last, again, but not least, he has studied a lot about Islam, and he can refer to the words of Messenger, Quran, Prophet Muhammad, and Imam Ali, and even Nahj al-Balagha, which is the book of Imam Ali, the first Iranian Shia Imam, which is 500, 600 pages. He has memorized all, and we don't have even 10 politicians in Iran which could have been able to memorize the whole book. That's why when he is giving speeches, always he refers to Quran, refers to Prophet Muhammad, to Imam Ali, and says, that's why we need changes. That's why we need to take care of the poor. That's why we need to bring this type of changes, developments in the economy, in the system. That's why our society is not an Islamic society.
All that said, early on, he did have a political reversal in that Javad Zarif, who was the vice president, very briefly, the vice president for strategic affairs, and more importantly, perhaps, had been one of his key advisors throughout the campaign, resigned. And he resigned with a bit of noise, complaining about the makeup of the cabinet. It wasn't what he had hoped for. It wasn't what he had advised, apparently. What does that tell us about the distribution of power in practical terms?
See, the issue surrounding Zarif's resignation was due to a legal matter. According to Iran's regulation, domestic internal regulations, individuals whose children or wife hold dual citizenship do not permit, they are not permitted to hold high ranking positions in the government. This is a law. Zarif's children were born in the US while he was a student in the US, and therefore they held American passports as well. After Zarif's resignation, there was a discussion within Iran about the interpretation of this regulation. And Zarif was reinstated to his post as vice president. Now he is vice president again. My understanding is that they interpreted the law to mean that it applies to individuals whose children were born in Iran, then migrated and acquired citizenship in another country. Zarif's children were born in the US while he was a student at an American university, not even during his official mission at the United Nations Embassy in New York. They automatically acquired U.S. citizenship by birth. It was not something that they were after. Based on this interpretation, disqualifying their father, whose hold exclusive Iranian citizenship, would not align with the spirit of this regulation. I think this was the interpretation. And that's why Zarif could come back and again be deputy president.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on TelbergFoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
So Peshkesian has a bit of wind in his sails. He's got the support, important support, as you've described, of the elite, of the supreme leader, and of the Revolutionary Guard. On the other hand, he's got a pile of problems that are, to put it mildly, significant. What do you expect? What do you think he can actually get done?
As I mentioned earlier, Pezeshkian's cabinet includes moderate individuals from both main Iranian political factions, while hardliners from both sides are not part of his cabinet. His government is almost a national unity cabinet, which increases the likelihood of positive changes during his term compared to previous administrations. Some of these challenges are domestic, his challenges, and over the past few months, we have been witnessing a reasonable progress in internal affairs. But I think the other part of his challenges are about foreign relations. One foreign relation issue is Iran's membership in FATF, the Financial Action Task Force, which Iran now is in blacklist. We have only two countries in blacklist, which is Iran and North Korea. During last decade, the hardline conservatives, they opposed Iranian membership to FATF. However, the chance of Iran joining the FATF under Pezeshkian's government is higher than ever, and I think he will be able to manage it. Another issue is the nuclear deal and mutual hostility between Iran and the U.S., which has practically and realistically affected all of Iran's relation with the Western world. Abbas Araghchi, Pezeshkian's foreign minister, and the deputy of Abbas Araghchi, which most probably would lead the nuclear talks, Majid Ravanchi, they were both previously negotiated and agreed on the JCPOA with the global powers. They were the real nuclear negotiators during President Rouhani, headed by Javad Zarif, which they could agree on the historical deal of JCPOA. So it appears to me that Pezeshkian's government is prepared to negotiate a new nuclear agreement and lifting sanctions. However, whether we like it or not, three external factors are at play, Alan. We cannot forget the realities. First, there is a need to wait for the U.S. presidential election to see whether the next U.S. president will also be willing to negotiate a new fair and balanced deal with Iran, whether this is nuclear or beyond nuclear. Second is about the role of Europe. Will the Europeans be willing to play a constructive, active, and positive role? Or will they, as they have in the past 3 years, be more Catholic than Pope? I mean, during the last 3 years, I would say Europeans, they were more Catholic than Pope. They had a more negative position against Iran compared to the Biden administration. And the third issue is whether the White House will shape its Iran policy based on Netanyahu's wishes or act independently. President Obama negotiated the nuclear deal independently of Netanyahu's policies, while President Trump withdrew from JCPOA and designated the Iranian Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization, aligning with Netanyahu's demands and wishes and policies. either we have President Harris, Vice President Harris, or former President Trump. Even if we have former President Trump, whether Trump would be ready for a new policy or he would follow exactly the same policy he had in his first term. It is not clear. No one knows. Therefore, we don't know what kind of White House we will have in January 2025. As long as these ambiguities are on the table, I really don't know whether Pezeshkian would be able to make a major shift on Iranian foreign relations or not.
But certainly context matters. And over the last 18 months, there have been two important, one perhaps more important than the other by orders of magnitude, developments. One is, of course, the Saudi-Iranian rapprochement, exchange of diplomatic relations across the Gulf. You've had relations with the Emirates, Now you have them with Saudi. And then secondly, the Gaza war and all of the events around the Gaza war, including the Israeli and Iranian exchange of direct attacks on each other's territory. So as for certain, you are right that the outcome of the American election will define who your potential negotiating partner is. Nonetheless, that context matters. And I would imagine that the way this war has unfolded, there is less room to maneuver on the American side, precisely because of the hostility between Israel and Iran, the actual fighting between Israel and Iran, that everyone is worried about manifesting itself larger, and indeed that the Americans have supported Israel in actual combat.
Actually, I believe that the Gaza war may not be a factor driving divergence between Iran and the regional countries. It could even be a factor for convergence because they are all pro-Palestinians. They are all opposing Netanyahu's policy. Whether we like it or not, unfortunately, Alan, 40,000 people, they have been killed in last 10, 11 months. 2 million people, they have been displaced. That's why Muslim countries, the regional countries, they are really angry and upset. Of course, they have different approaches. I mean, the approaches of Saudi toward the Gaza war is different with Iran, but in principle, they are all opposing Netanyahu's policy against Palestinians. However, the issue of Iran-U.S. relation is crucial. If the U.S. continues its policy of hostility and increasing pressure, sanctions on Iran, I think no major positive developments will occur in Iran's relation with the regional countries, especially with the neighboring Arab countries in the Persian Gulf. But if Washington and Tehran adopt a policy of engagement, manage to reduce hostilities, de-escalate regional tensions, and improve relations, which I have been insisting, talking, writing for 15 years, trying to encourage Tehran and Washington to go toward engagement, a broad negotiations, reduce the hostilities, stop regional tensions, and try to improve relations. If it happens, Alan, I think we will have three significant positive developments. One, there could be a greater cooperation and convergence between Iran and its neighbors, with even the possibility of establishing a collective cooperation system in the Persian Gulf. Look, Alan, it is more than a decade that the U.S. is trying to decrease the level of its investment presence in the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf, and pivot to China, the Eastern Bloc powers, Russia, and so. But they have failed. In the region, we have too many problems, but I would say the most important two is number one, Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and number two is the difference and tensions between Iran and the Arabs, Persian Arabs. If we have a regional cooperation system in the Persian Gulf, like a type of cooperation Europeans they have, and the regional countries, they all would cooperate for security stability in the Persian Gulf. And then this would really help the U.S. to minimize or to decrease its presence in the region. The second major development would be that Iran could maintain a balanced relationship with the Eastern and Western powers. We have seen during last 20 years, especially after Trump withdrew from the JCPOA, more U.S.-West pressure, sanction, coercion strategy against Iran has led to Iranian more cooperation between Iran with Russia, China, or Iranian dependency to the Eastern Bloc, or Iran pivot to the East. You remember when we had JCPOA agreed in 2015, tens of billions of dollars of economic agreement was signed between Iran and Europeans, Iran and Western countries, even Iran and the U.S. But when Trump withdrew from the JCPOA, imposed the sanction, the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei said enough is enough. We cannot trust the U.S. They are not going to keep their promise. Now we are disappointed even from Europeans. Now we go to the East, he publicly said. But if we have rapprochement, if we have a new nuclear deal and even beyond nuclear, then Iran would be able to keep its position, a balanced relation with the West and with the East, which is extremely important and which is a part of Iranian constitution. And the third, as you mentioned, about Israel-Iran conflict, Alan, you have seen my op-eds, my articles, my speeches, always during last 2-3 years, even before war on Gaza or Israeli-Hamas war, October 7, 2023, I have been insisting on the necessity of a type of ceasefire between Iran and Israel. If there is a U.S.-Iran rapprochement, the chance of a type of ceasefire between Iran and Israel, as well as Iran's regional allies, I think would increase.
That may well be, but we are where we are, and there's a lot of evidence that Iran and Russia, as you said, have become closer. Even during the Ukraine war, lots of reports of Iranian weapons showing up on that front. We know that the Houthis, in fact, are using Iranian drones and other equipment. Is it too late to go back? That is to say, the Iranian-Russian relationship has been transformed by events. And again, we are where we are. How do you undo that?
I don't believe, Alan, this is too late, because Iranian constitution insists in the first chapters that Iran should and would and must have a balanced relation with the East and the West. Iran should not be dependent either to East or to the West. Therefore, any establishment, any administration, parliament in Iran is mandated to follow the constitution. And you have seen during last 2 years, Alan, in Iranian media, social media, there is big, big, big debate why we should not improve the relation with the West, why Iran should be dependent to Russia. There is a huge opposition within the grassroots and the people, because the people, they really don't like to be puppet of the West or the East. It doesn't matter. I mean, the reason we had revolution in Iran in 1979 was that practically Iran was the puppet of the U.S. Practically U.S. dominated Iran. It created the reaction of Iranian nation, a nation whom you know very well with 1,000 years of history and civilization. It was really humiliating for the nation to be dominated by a foreign power, whether this is UK or US. And now there is a huge fear in the public whether Iran would again be a new puppet or dependent to China or Russia or Eastern Bloc or not. That's why I think it is not late. It depends to the West. It depends to the US and Europe what type of policy they are going to have, either the policies they have imposed during last 10 years at least, or after departure of from JCPOA, or they are going to have a policy of engagement like what we experienced during President Obama.
Hussein, let's leave it there. This podcast is entitled New Thinking, and this is new thinking. That is to say that we maybe have to find ways around the stalemate and reimagine the relationships among the countries in the Gulf, whether it's the Arabian Gulf or the Persian Gulf, depends who I'm talking to, as well as among the great powers that have a history in the Gulf. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Alan. I wish you all the best. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.